69. Behind a closed visor. The officer who came on duty late that Sunday evening was a trim young lieutenant with two token squares of moustache under his nostrils. After lights out, he paraded in person along the upper and lower hallways of the special prison, chasing the prisoners, always reluctant to turn in on Sundays, to bed. He would have made a second sally if he could have torn himself away from the buxom little nurse in the sick bay. She had a husband in Moscow, but he could not reach her in the restricted area during the 24 hours she would be on duty. The lieutenant had high hopes that this was his night to get somewhere with her, though so far she had eluded his grasp, laughingly telling him over and over again to stop playing the fool. So, instead of chasing the prisoners a second time, he sent his aide, the sergeant major. Knowing that the lieutenant would not check up on him, indeed would not set foot outside the sick bay before morning, the sergeant major made no great effort to put them all to bed. For one thing, after many years of service, he had finally tired of being a police dog, and for another, he knew that grown men who had to go to work the next day would not forget that they needed sleep. Extinguishing the lights in the hallways and on the stairs of the special prison was not allowed, because it might help escapers or rioters. So Reuben and Sologdin had twice avoided dismissal, and still stood hugging the wall in the main hallway. It was after midnight, but they had no thought of sleep. It was one of those furious, unresolvable arguments with which Russians, unless they come to blows instead, like to conclude a convivial evening. But it was also the sort of ferocious argument that can take place only in jail. Outside, a single view, that of the regime, reigns unchallenged. The duel on paper had proved a failure. In the past hour or so, Reuben and Sologdin had taken the other two laws of the hapless dialectic apart, but the arguments they bounced off each other, finding no snag, no salutary ledge to slow their descent, rolled rapidly into the mouth of the volcano. If there are no contradictions, then there is no unity either. So? What do you mean, so? You're afraid of your own shadow. Am I right or am I wrong? Right, of course. Sologdin beamed. Fired by this glimpse of a weak spot in Reuben's defences, he crouched, sharp-featured, ready to pounce. Well, then, whatever is free of contradictions doesn't exist. So why did you promise a classless society? Class is a foreign word. Don't try to wriggle out of it. You know that a society free of contradictions is an impossibility, yet you shamelessly promised it. You... In 1917 they had both been 5-year-olds, but each of them, in his argument with the other, was ready to answer for the whole history of mankind. You crucified yourselves to do away with oppression, but you inflicted worse, far worse, oppressors on us. Was it worth killing so many millions of people for that?
You're too jaundiced to see clearly,
Reuben shouted, forgetting the need to lower his voice for fear of compromising the opponent who was so eager to throttle him. His own arguments, however loud, could not damage him, since he was on the side of the regime.
When you enter the classless society, your hatred will still prevent you from recognizing it.
But right now, is it classless now? Give me a straight answer, just this once. Just for once, don't dodge the question. Is there or is there not a new class, a ruling class?
How difficult Reuben found it to answer that very question. He could see for himself that there was such a class, and that if it entrenched itself, it would deprive the revolution of all sense and meaning. But no shadow of weakness, no hint of uncertainty troubled the lofty brow of this true believer.
"Do you mean it's detached from the rest of society?" he asked loudly. Can you really distinguish precisely between the rulers and the ruled?
Sologdin's voice rang out boldly in reply.
I can indeed. Foma, Anton, and Shishkin Mushkin are the rulers, and we
know. But are there really any fixed lines of demarcation? Class divisions resulting from inheritance of property? No. Everything has to be earned by service. Prince today in the gutter tomorrow. Isn't that the way of it?
If it is, so much the worse. If every member of society can be brought down, there's only one way he can make sure of survival, by doing whatever he's ordered to do. A gentleman in the old days could be as impertinent as he liked. The powers that be couldn't take his noble birth away from him.
You and your precious little gentlemen. People like Siramacha.
Siramacha was the Sharashka's number one stool pigeon.
Or take the merchant class. The market forced them to use their heads and react to changed circumstances quickly. Not like those friends of yours. Just think what a hopeless bunch they are. No concept of honour, no breeding, no education, no imagination. They hate freedom. The only way they can hang on to their positions is by debasing themselves.
It doesn't take much intelligence to realise that this is a transitional bureaucratic group, and that as the state withers away...
Wither away? Sologdin yelled. Those people, voluntarily. They won't go away till they're slung out by the scruffs of their necks. Your state wasn't created because of the money bags, meaning capitalist encirclement. It was created to cement, by cruelty, an unnatural way of life. If you people were alone on this earth, you'd go on forever making your state stronger and stronger.
With so many years of repression and forced silence behind him, it was an immense relief to fling his views in the face of a companion who would listen, and who was at the same time a confirmed Bolshevik, and so, of course, responsible for all that had happened. For his part, Rubin had outraged all those he had encountered from his first days in the counter-espionage unit's cell at the front, and through a long succession of cells elsewhere, by proudly proclaiming that he was a Marxist and had no intention of renouncing his views, even in prison. He had grown used to being a sheepdog in a pack of wolves, defending himself single-handedly against 40 or 50 at a time. His lips were raw and cracked from futile arguments, but it was his duty, his absolute duty, to explain to the blind their blindness, to wrestle with enemies among his cellmates in order to save them, since most of them were not really enemies but ordinary Soviet people, victims of progress and the imperfections of the penal system. Personal grievances had clouded their consciousness, but if war with America should break out tomorrow, and these people were given weapons, they would almost to a man forget how their lives had been shattered, forgive their tormentors, think no more of the grief their sundered families had suffered, and rush to sacrifice themselves in defence of socialism, as Rubin himself would. At the critical moment, Sologdin would obviously do the same. It could not be otherwise. Only dogs and traitors would behave differently. Their argument bounded over sharp, lacerating stones until it reached this very point. Where, I ask you, is the difference? According to you, a former Zek who's done 10 years for squat and turns his weapons against his jailers is a traitor to his country, whereas the German whom you have processed and sent back to his own lines to break his oath of loyalty and betray his fatherland, you call a progressive.
How can you compare the two?
Rubin sounded astonished.
Objectively, my German is for socialism, and your Zek is against it. Can you really say there's any comparison?
If the hot fury expressed in them could melt the substance eyes are made of, Sologdin's eyes would have gushed out in blue streams.
It's no good talking to you. For 30 years you've lived by this device.
In the heat of the moment he let slip the foreign word, but it was a good one, from the age of chivalry.
The end justifies the means. But if you were asked point blank whether that's what you believe, I'm sure you'd deny it. Oh, yes, you would.
What makes you think so?
Rubin asked, cool and conciliatory.
In my personal affairs, I don't acknowledge it. But if we're talking about society as a whole, that's another matter. For the first time in human history, our aim is so lofty that we can say just that. The end justifies the means employed for its attainment.
So you're prepared to go that far?
Sologdin's rapier sang as he lunged at a vulnerable spot.
Just remember this, then, that the loftier your aim, the nobler must be your means. Treacherous means destroy the end itself.
What do you call treacherous means? Are you perhaps denying the legitimacy of revolutionary means?
When did you ever have a revolution? Mayhem isn't revolution. Axes dripping blood aren't revolution. Who could even begin counting those massacred or executed? The world would be horror-struck.
Like an express train rushing through the night, stopping nowhere, past rural stops, past wayside signal lights, across empty steps and through brightly lit towns. Their argument sped over light and dark places in their memories, and everything that briefly loomed through an uncertain light on elicited a muffled echo from their uncontrollably swaying, coupled thoughts.
"To pass judgment on a country, you must first know at least a little about it," Reuben said angrily. "You've been mouldering in camps for 12 years, and how much did you see before that? The Patriarch's ponds? Did you go on Sunday outings to Kolomenskaya?"
"What gives you the right to judge?"
Sologdin kept his voice down to a muffled cry, as though he were being strangled.
"Shame on you. You should be ashamed. Remember all those who went through Butyrki prison when you were there. Gromov, Ivantyev, Yashin, Blachin. They told you the sober truth, told you their life stories. Don't tell me you weren't listening. And what about this place? What about Vartapyatov? Or that other man? What's his name now?"
"Who? Who? Why should I listen to them? Blind men, all of them. All they do is howl like beasts with their paws caught in a trap. As they see it, their own failure in life means that socialism is a flop. Their observatory is the slop bucket. The aromas of the slop bucket are the breath of life to them."
"Is there anybody, then, anybody at all you're capable of listening to? If so, who?"
"The young. The young are on our side, and they are the future."
"The young? You're imagining things. They couldn't care less about your shining lights," meaning ideals.
"What gives you the right to speak for the young? I fought in the front line with them, went on reconnaissance with them, and all you know is what you've heard from some wretched emigre in a transit prison. How can you say the young have no ideology when there are 10 million Komsomols in the country?"
"Komsomols? Komsomols? Are you a half-wit or something? What you call the League of Communist Youth is just a device for the conversion of wrapping paper into membership books."
"Watch your mouth. I was a member myself. The Komsomol was our banner, our conscience, our selfless, romantic dream. The Komsomol movement was all that to us. Gone and best forgotten. Anyway, who's talking? After all, you were a Komsomol yourself in those days."
"Yes, and I've paid in full for it. Been punished for it. You make a deal with Mephistopheles, Margarita. Her honour lost, her brother dead, a child dead, madness, perdition."
"Never mind, Margarita. It can't be true that your Komsomol days have left nothing in your soul."
"Soul, did you say? How your language has changed in the last 20 years. Nowadays you talk about the soul and conscience and sacrilege. I would have loved to hear you utter such words in your pious communist days in 1927. You corrupted a whole generation of young Russians."
"Looking at you, you could be right."
"And then you set to work on the Germans, the Poles." On and on they charged, incapable now of matching argument and response, their thoughts no longer following each other in logical sequence, with no eyes for, no awareness of, the hallway, in which the only others left were two fanatical chess players and the old blacksmith with his hacking smoker's cough, and where their agitated arm-waving, their inflamed faces and their aggressively poised beards, one black and bristly, one neat and fair, were so conspicuous.
"Glib!
Glib!"
Seeing Nyezhin and Spiridon coming upstairs from the bathroom, they both called out at once, each of them hoping to double his forces. Gleb was walking toward them anyway, alarmed by their shouting and gesticulation. Any passing idiot would have realized without hearing a word that they had gotten on to dangerous political matters. Nyezhin went up to them quickly, and before they could, both at once, fire contradictory questions at him, prodded each of them in the ribs.
"Sense! Sense!"
This was the code word they had all three agreed on. If two of them were involved in a heated argument, the third would put a stop to it by reminding them in this way of the danger of informers.
"Have you gone mad? You've already earned yourselves another tenner each. Aren't you satisfied? Dmitri, think of your family."
There was no hope of parting them peacefully, or, for that matter, with a jet from a hose.
"Just listen to him," Sologdin said, shaking Gleb by the shoulder. "He sets all our sufferings at naught. They're warranted, as far as he's concerned. The only sufferings he cares about are those of Negroes on plantations.
Well, I've told Lev before, charity begins at home.
What narrowness! You're no internationalist, Reuben exclaimed,
glaring at Nerjan as though he were a pickpocket caught in the act.
You should have heard the rot he's been talking. He thinks the autocracy was a blessing for Russia. All our conquests, all our dirty tricks, the Straits, Poland, Central Asia.
Nerjan's verdict was swift and firm. In my view, it's high time we set all our colonies free for the salvation of Russia and concentrated our people's efforts on the internal development of the country.
That's childish,
Sologdin retorted peevishly.
If you had a free hand, you'd shake the land of your fathers to pieces. You tell him, is all that Komsomol romanticism of theirs worth a bent kopeck? Remember how they taught peasant children to denounce their parents? How they wouldn't leave those who'd grown the grain so much as husks to choke on? And he has the nerve to mouth the word virtue.
No, a noble soul you are. Call yourself a Christian? You're nothing of the sort.
Don't blaspheme. Don't talk about things you don't understand.
You think that just because you aren't a thief or an informer, that's enough to make you a Christian? Where's your love for your neighbour? There's a saying that just fits you. The hand that makes the sign of the cross also sharpens the knife. No wonder you're such a fan of medieval bandits. You're a typical conquistador.
Flatterer.
Sologdin struck a picturesque pose.
You're flattered? Horrible! Horrible!
Reuben ran the fingers of both hands through his thinning hair.
Do you hear him, Glib? Tell him what a poseur he is. I'm fed up with his posturing. He's forever pretending to be Alexander Nevsky.
Now that I don't find a bit flattering.
What do you mean?
Alexander Nevsky is no sort of hero, as far as I'm concerned, and no saint. So I don't take what you said as a compliment.
Reuben was silenced. He and Nerjan exchanged a baffled look.
So what has Alexander Nevsky done to upset you?
Nerjan asked.
Kept chivalry out of Asia and Catholicism out of Russia. He was against Europe,
Sologdin said, still breathless with indignation. Reuben returned to the attack, hoping to land a blow.
Now this is something new, something quite new.
Why would Catholicism have been good for Russia?
Nerjan inquired, looking judicial.
I'll tell you why.
The answer came like a flash of lightning.
Because all the people who had the misfortune to be Orthodox Christians paid for it with centuries of slavery. Because the Orthodox Church never could stand up to the state. A godless people was defenseless. The result was this cockeyed country of ours, a country of slaves.
Nerjan's eyes were popping out.
I just don't understand. Wasn't it you who blamed me for not being patriotic enough? Now you're giving the land of your fathers a drubbing.
But Reuben had seen a break in his enemy's defences. He leapt in quickly.
What's become of Holy Russia, and the language of utter clarity, and the campaign against birds' words?
Yes, indeed, added Nerjan. What's the point of the language of utter clarity if ours is a cockeyed country?
Sologdin beamed. He stretched out his arms and made circular movements with his hands.
A game, gentlemen, a game. A joust with lowered visor. We all need exercise. We must strive at all times to overcome resistance. We are imprisoned for good, and we must pretend to hold views as remote as possible from our real ones. As I've told you, one of the nine spheres...
Roundnesses, you mean?
No, spheres.
Reuben flared up again.
So that was humbug, too. This country isn't good enough for you. But who, if not you reckless god-botherers, was responsible for Khadinka and Tsushima and the debacle of 1915?
Sologdin gasped.
So the murderers' hearts bleed for Russia now, do they? Wasn't it you who butchered Russia in 1917?
Sense, sense!
Glib punched both of them in the ribs again. But the debaters were oblivious. They could no longer see him through the red mist before their eyes.
What makes you think you'll ever be forgiven for collectivization?
Remember what you told us in Butyrki.
that your only object in life was to grab yourself a million. Why do you need a million to get to the kingdom of heaven?"
They had known each other for 2 years, and now they were distorting all that they had learned about each other in heart-to-heart conversations, insulting each other as hurtfully as they could. Every little thing either of them could recall was flung in the other's face as an accusation.
"Don't you understand ordinary human language?"
Yezhin croaked.
"Wrap it up! Wrap it up!"
He made a helpless gesture and left them to it. At least there was nobody else in the hallway, and all those in the rooms were asleep.
"Shame on you, you corrupter of men's souls! Those creatures who preside over East Germany are your nurslings. You puffed-up pygmy! How pathetically proud you are of your drop of gentry blood!
If the Shishkin Mushkins are furthering the good cause, why don't you help them? Why not squeal for them? Shishkin, too, will give you a good report, and they'll review your case.
Talking like that could get you a bloody nose.
I don't see why. Look at it this way. Since all the rest of us are rightly here and only you are not, our jailers must be in the right. That's only logical." By now they were exchanging random insults, scarcely listening to each other, each of them intent on one thing only, landing his blows where they would hurt most.
"You're an inveterate liar. Everything you do and say rests on a lie. Yet you pontificate as though you never let go of your crucifix.
You didn't want to discuss the importance of pride in a man's life, but you really should try to borrow a bit of pride from somewhere. Twice a year you humbly petition them for a pardon."
"Lies! For a review of my case, not a pardon."
"The answer's always no, but you go on humbly begging. You're like a little dog on a chain. Whoever holds the chain has you in his power."
"Wouldn't you humbly beg if you could? In your case, release is ruled out. Otherwise, you'd crawl on your belly for it."
Sir Logdin shook with indignation.
"Never." "I tell you, you would. You just lack the means of attracting attention."
They had tormented each other to the point of exhaustion. Innocenti Volodin could not have imagined that his fate would be influenced by a tedious nocturnal argument between two prisoners in a sealed and secluded building on the outskirts of Moscow. Each of them wanted to be executioner, but both were victims in this quarrel. They had long ago lost the thread, and the quarrel was not really theirs, but between two radically opposed and equally destructive forces. Each was well aware of the other's destructive potential. Each knew for certain that whether yesterday's or tomorrow's blind and mindless conquerors prevailed, both were as impervious to reason as those prison walls. Rubin was almost tearing his hair.
"Tell me this, then. If you always thought as you do now, how could you join the Komsomol?"
For the second time in half an hour, Sir Logdin was so exasperated that he betrayed himself unnecessarily.
"What else could I do? Did you leave us the option of not joining? If I hadn't been in the Komsomol, I wouldn't have gotten into the Institute in 1,000 years. I'd have been digging ditches." "So you pretended. You put on a disgusting little act."
"No. I simply went into the attack with visor lowered." What Rubin inferred from this was agonizing, heart-stopping.
"So, if there's a war, and you get your hands on a weapon?"
Sir Logdin raised himself to his full height, folded his arms, and backed away from Rubin as though he had leprosy. "You don't think I'd defend you, do you?"
"Your words reek of blood."
Rubin clenched his hairy fists. Whatever they said or did next, take each other by the throat, fly at each other with fists flailing, would have been a feeble expression of their feelings. All that was left to them was to seize machine guns and fire a burst. That was the only language the loser would have understood. But there were no machine guns. They parted, breathing heavily, Rubin hanging his head, Sir Logdin head in the air. Sir Logdin might have hesitated earlier, but now he savored in advance the joy of hitting those dirty dogs where it hurt. Don't give them their encoder. Don't let them have it. You don't have to be one of those pulling their triumphal chariot. If you do, you'll never show them up for the mediocrities they are. They shout themselves hoarse. They deafen us with their laws of historical inevitability. "It cannot be otherwise," is their constant cry. They write history the way they want it, twist the hidden causes to suit themselves. Reuben went away to his corner and clasped his painfully throbbing head in his hands. He saw clearly now that there was one, only one, crushing blow he could inflict on Sir Logdin and the whole pack of Sir Logdins. The only way to ram anything into those thick heads. No factual arguments, no historical justification would ever convince them that you were right. The atomic bomb, that was the one thing they would understand. He must overcome his illness, his weakness, his reluctance. And, first thing tomorrow morning, get his nose down and pick up the trail of that anonymous miscreant. He must save the atomic bomb for the revolution. Petrov, Siagaviti, Volodin, Shevronik, Zavarzin.